Hello, and happy Father's Day from the Greenlight Bookstore podcast. We're an independent bookstore with two locations in Brooklyn, New York, one in Fort Greene and one in Prospect Lefferts Gardens. Today we'll be listening to an event we had at St. Joseph's College for the Brooklyn Voices series. Pulitzer-winning, best-selling author Michael Chabon talks about his new book, Pops, Fatherhood in Pieces, with author Julie Oringer. Enjoy.
Hi. Hi. I have had such a good day. I was walking around Brooklyn all day long today and went to Red Hook, where I had never been before. Or I think I was there once a long time ago, but it was at night, and I didn't realize how magical a place Red Hook really is. And then we walked all the way, almost all the way back here. And I had a wonderful day in Brooklyn, and I'm very happy to end it in this way with you guys. Thanks for coming out. I'm going to read the introductory essay to this book, which is called The Opposite of Writing. It's short. At a literary party the summer before my first novel was published, I found myself alone with a writer I admired on the deck of our host's house along the Truckee River. People came and went with blue Mexican wine glasses and bottles of beer, but I sensed that, for whatever reason, I had the man's attention. "I'm going to give you some advice," he told me, a warning edge to his voice. I said I would appreciate that. I was curious to hear what he had to say. Not because I felt in need of advice, but as a clue to the mystery of the great man himself. He presented a smooth surface without chinks or toeholds, the studied amiability of someone unaccustomed to giving himself away. Advice might be the only clue I was going to get. The great man said that his advice was going to be painful. Or maybe that was just in his tone. But he knew what he was talking about, and if I wanted to make a go of it as a novelist, I would do well to pay attention. The guy was nearly twice my age, but he was not old. He was young enough, for example, to wear black Chuck Taylors. He was young enough to smile ironically at himself, laying the Polonius routine on some raw hurler of metaphors out of UC Irvine. "Don't have children," he said. "That's it. Do not." The smile faded, but its ghost lingered a moment in his blue eyes. "That is the whole of the law." I was due to marry my future ex-wife in under a month. My book would come out the following spring. It turned out that this conjunction of circumstances, in the view of the famous writer, was cause for alarm. Now, marriage was fine. In fact, all of the guy's books were dedicated to his long-suffering wife. But if you were not careful, you would run a serious risk of damaging your career. After this one, he patiently explained, there would be a second novel to write, and second novels were notoriously thornier and more unwieldy than debuts. Following the inevitable sophomore cock-up, if I were lucky and stubborn in the proper measure, I would go on to tackle the magisterial third and fourth novels, and then the quirky fifth, the slim and elegant sixth, the seventh that in some way would recapitulate and ring the changes on all its predecessors, and so on, for as long as my stubbornness and luck held out. Unless, of course, I made the fatal mistake of so many would-be young hotshots before me. You could write great books, the great man continued, or you could have kids. It's up to you. I nodded reeling a little at the prophecy he had just laid down for me, a career of struggle and triumph stacked up to the heavens like Babel, book by torturous book. I never thought about it that way, I confessed. My future ex-wife and I had gotten so far as the usual drawing up of rotisserie league baby name rosters, but no further. Did I need to put an immediate halt to these playful conversations, along with any more earnest ones that might arise? She was a poet with ambitions of her own. Poe, he said, O'Connor, Welty, none of them had children. This was a list that, by implication, included him. He was a Southerner himself, and he and his beloved dedicatee were childless, too. Chekhov, Beckett, Wolfe. I tried to muster some counterexamples. But alas, the one who came immediately to mind was my current idol, John Cheever, packed into a house in Ossining with his aggrieved wife and three children. I had just been reading the memoirs of his daughter, Susan. Her childhood had been quietly calamitous. Her father's career, a farrago of alcoholism, shame, and secret homosexuality. The short stories had, over time, come unbuttoned, the novels proceeding with the sham dignity and slow gait of drunks trying to pass for sober, while the children alternated between hoping desperately to be seen and trying to keep out of the way. It was at least arguable, I guessed, that the man ought never to have had children at all. I wondered how Susan Cheever would feel about that proposition, though. Put it this way, the great man said, and then he sketched out the brutal logic. Writing was a practice. The more you wrote, the better a writer you became, and the more books you produced. Excellence plus productivity, that was the formula for sustained success, and time was the coefficient of both. Children, the great man said, were notorious thieves of time. Then there was the question of subject matter, settings, experiences. Books were hungry things, and if you stayed too long in any one place, they would consume everything and everyone around you. You needed to keep moving, always onward, a literary Maasai driving your ravenous herd of novels. Travel, therefore, was a must. And I should take his word for it because he had made a careful study. Traveling with children was the world's biggest pain in the ass. Anyway, writers were restless folk. They could not thrive without being able to pick up and go wherever and whenever it suited them. Writers needed to be irresponsible, ultimately, to everything but the writing, free of commitments to everything but the daily word count. Children, by contrast, needed stability, consistency, routine, and above all, commitment. In short, he was saying, children are the opposite of writing. Thomas Mann? I tried. I'd been racking my brain to think of a great writer who was a family man, but not calamitously so, like Cheever. My enthusiasm for Mann had faded of late, but I would never forget the rapture of the summer I had spent 5 years earlier climbing the Magic Mountain. Thomas Mann, the great man said. He grinned. I had walked right into his trap. Thomas Mann used to lock himself in his room every day for hours. His children were forbidden to disturb him on pain of death. And that's barely an exaggeration. His children were a disturbance to him. When he was working, they were a source of pain. I mean, forget the question of getting your work done. Is that the kind of father you want to be? That was an easy one to answer. I knew, without ever having discussed it with my future ex-wife or anyone, the kind of father I wanted to be. Unlike my own father, I would be around for my children whenever they needed me, over breakfast, doing homework, when they learned to swim, to cook, to ride a bicycle, when they cried into their pillows. I would be present in my children's lives. In short, my door would always be open to them. Until now, it had never occurred to me that this ambition might be incompatible with the practice of writing. Richard Yates, said the great man, preparing to deliver the Tercio de Muerte, like one of Hemingway's matadors. You know what Richard Yates said? Oh, no, I thought. I revered the bleak and gimlet-eyed Yates for Easter Parade and Revolutionary Road and 11 Kinds of Loneliness, but no way was this going to be anything but grim. You lose a book, the great man quoted, or paraphrased, or possibly invented himself, for every child. Now the great man smiled. He could see the effect that his words were having on me as I stood there trying to reckon how many books I stood or would stand to lose. My future ex-wife and I had settled on two names, one male, one female. This suggested a worst case of two books. Two books erased, wiped away by the universal solvent of children. I supposed I could live with that. But what if, after the first two, there was an accident? Too much wine in the afternoon, a failure of birth control. What if, God forbid, that third pregnancy turned out to be twins? Suddenly, in my imagination, I was clinging to the base of that half-built Babel, up to my ankles in a roiling surf of babies and brats, the non-author of an entire shelf of great novels. I would never be able to write any one of them, conceivably, my masterpiece. All right, Michael, you think about it, said the great man in that accent like butter on a warm biscuit. His work was done. He patted me on the shoulder, rattled the last half inch of Dos Equis in his bottle, and went back inside the house, confident of having saved, or at least of having frightened, another lost lamb. I have a vague recollection of reporting this conversation afterward to my future ex-wife and of our laughing it off as arrogant self-justification, or perhaps more pitiably, making virtue of necessity. We got married, moved a few times, got divorced. I managed to snatch a handful of gently embittered short stories out of that Gilligan-esque pleasure cruise. Though the second novel I attempted to build and launch over the course of those years, a would-be epic, sank like a vast, unseaworthy dreadnought, unsalvageable to the bottom of my soul. Fortunately, there were no children to blame for that shipwreck. A couple of years later, I married again, and over the quarter century that has followed while fathering four children, I've managed to turn out 14 books. Should there be 18? Is the creative wistfulness that sometimes comes over me after a rough night at the keyboard, that feeling of having somehow wandered by mistake into the wrong book, a kind of mourning for the loss of those other phantom limb novels, the ones that my children stole? It's certainly the case that if one were to plot on a graph my declining output of short stories over the past two decades, alongside my rising output of children, the resulting X would seem to mark the scene of a crime. But the reason I almost never write short stories anymore isn't that my children are time thieves. It's that my children are expensive. And short stories just don't pay very well. I can't afford to write short stories anymore. And those four lost novels predicted by the great man's theory all those years ago, setting aside for the moment the question of whether you can lose something that you never had, And the fact that going around telling people you lose a book for every child sounds like exactly the kind of romantically unromantic self-pity you would expect from the full-blown raging alcoholic that Richard Yates had apparently become by the end of his life. If I had followed the great man's advice and never burdened myself with the gift of my children, or if I had never written any novels at all, in the long run, the result would have been the same as the result will be for me here, having made the choice I made. I will die. And the world, in its violence and serenity, will roll on through the endless indifference of space, and it will take only 100 of its circuits around the sun to turn the 6 of us who loved each other to dust, and consign to oblivion all but a scant few of the thousands upon thousands of novels and short stories written and published during our lifetimes. If none of my books turns out to be among that bright remnant because I allowed my children to steal my time, narrow my compass, and curtail my freedom, I'm all right with that. Once they're written, my books, unlike my children, hold no wonder for me. No mystery resides in them. Unlike my children, my books are cruelly unforgiving of my weaknesses, failings, and flaws of character. Most of all, my books, unlike my children, do not love me back. Anyway, if 100 years hence, those books lie moldering and forgotten, I'll never know. That's the problem in the end with putting all your chips on posterity. You never stick around long enough to enjoy it. That's it. Thank you. Thanks.
Hi. Hi, everybody.
This is Julie.
I'm Julie. This is a small library I've brought with me to assist us.
I didn't have a chance to prepare for the quiz. I'm sorry. Is it?
You already know all the answers.
Okay.
So don't worry.
Right. I see James Baldwin there.
So I don't even know if you know this or not, but at your house in Maine one summer, at a Sunday night dinner, the writer who you mentioned was present, and he and I were having a conversation out by the barbecue grill.
And did he have some advice for you?
In which he said, "Well, what are you guys up to these days, you and Ryan, my husband and I?" And I said, "Well, I'm finishing a novel sometime within the next couple of years, and we're thinking about having a child." And he said, without couching the proscription in Yates's voice or anyone else's, "You know, Julie, that for every child you have, you lose a
book." Oh, my God. So now he's just owning it. He's owning
it. Yes, he made it his own. He made it his own. And that became kind of a joke between Ryan and me from then on. You know, we managed to get pregnant. Eventually, we managed to get pregnant again. And we were sort of calculating, does it work for both? Does it actually count as 4 books? You know, for my husband's a writer as well. You know, did I lose 2 and he lost 2?
Or is it like exponential, maybe?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Maybe we lost 8. So I guess the question that I wanted to ask you, I mean, it's funny to even be having this conversation because... allow me my moment of public admiration. I've known you for almost as long as I've been a writer and certainly longer than I've been a parent. And I feel like I have learned so much about what it is to be both of those things from knowing you.
From watching us make all of our mistakes over and over again.
And from hearing how you kindly interpreted all the mistakes we made as perhaps not being so disastrous, considering that your children turned out to be the amazing people that they did.
Thank you.
I guess the first question that I wanted to ask you is, considering that it's true that children take time, mm-hmm. and that writing takes time, and considering that you and Ayelet have managed to create this fine balance between the two, mm-hmm. at least from my perspective, yes. and I know both of you pretty well, mm-hmm. How did you two begin to negotiate that within your marriage? How did you, knowing that both of those things were going to be essential to you, what was the process of beginning to work out how that was actually going to make sense for your lives?
Well, I mean, in a way, the equation changed, because when we met, Ayelet was about to embark on a career as a criminal defense lawyer. Right. And she did that for about 4 or 5 years. And she, in the beginning, when we first decided to have children, she was actually, I mean, lawyers work hard and they work a lot. She wasn't going to be around that much, and I was going to be taking on, in theory, the burden of the child rearing and doing my writing. And maybe right. we would have a nanny or some kind of help in some way, but it would be sort of for me, because she was going to be working these long hours as a federal public defender. And in a way, the reason that changed, and part of the reason that Ayelet decided to stop working as a lawyer and to eventually, she stayed home and then eventually found her way to writing herself, was because she saw how much time I was spending with Sophie, with our oldest kid, and she was jealous. I mean, she was envious of how much time, and like she would call me during the day from the Metropolitan Detention Center in downtown Los Angeles, and you know, and say like, "What are you doing?" And I was like, "Well, we just had a bath," and like, you know, and I was really into dressing, like playing with Sophie like a doll when she was little, and like she had lots of outfits. People had given us all these outfits, and we would go through like 5 or 6 outfits in a day.
Right.
Like I was just playing with the baby.
You
pretty...
just introduced the fashion theme in the book, by
yes,
the way.
Yes, exactly. It was the doll.
Now we know
my fashion
where this
doll.
Originated.
And that sounded really sweet to her, like a sweet life. So she decided to sort of stay home eventually, but that didn't satisfy her either. So then she started to write. We didn't really have to start negotiating the writing time versus the child rearing time until after we had our second kid. And that's when she decided, "I'm never going to go back to work as a lawyer, and I got to find something else to do." And she wrote her first murder mystery. It's not so much in our marriage, in our house, it's not so much about negotiating division of labor. Like I came into marriage already very clear, and having been married once before, my sense of the importance of sharing all the tasks equally had very much, I had learned, I mean, my first marriage obviously didn't work out, but I learned a lot from it. My first wife was older than I am, and she had very high expectations, and I learned things like unloading the dishwasher, you know, if you see some wet clothes in the washing machine, move them into the dryer. Like, you know, I learned these sort of rudimentary skills, the skills that seem to me like now when I look back, like, how could I not have known that? But anyway, you know, by the time I married Ayelet, I was very clear, you know, 50-50, and not just like a man's perception of 50-50, which is more like 70-30, female to male, but true 50-50. You know, that has worked for us, and we spell each other in various ways, you know, and if I want to go away to the McDowell Colony or borrow a friend's cabin somewhere and go away for a week to work, you know, then she gets to do that the next time, or, you know, right. we spell each other in various ways. I think that is an issue. It does need to be worked out. It works differently in different writer households, and if you have two writer spouses, it's different than if only one of the spouses is a partner, is a writer. But to me, more than any of those things, the thing that having children does that really impinges on your writing, that in some ways makes it impossible in the same way that you were able to do it before you had children, is... the way that your work, your actual writing work, stops the moment you stop writing. Because as soon as you stop writing, you have to go into kid world and deal with all that shit. And deal with, if it's baby shit, then literal and figurative, then it's that. If it's like older kids, if it's driving, making appointments, scheduling, cooking dinner, doing the shopping, all that stuff, being with them, listening to their problems. And while you're doing all those things, you're not writing anymore.
Right.
That all got turned off. And to get into that state that I could get in before I had children, and then I now have to go away to a place like the McDowell Colony for 2 weeks to get into that state where even when you're not working, you're working. When you finish your work for the day,
right?
There's no, you stay in the writing space in your somewhere in your mind so that everything that's happening to you feeds back into the writing. And sometimes I'll be like, I won't have been working for an hour and a half, and suddenly I'll see something, I'll have a chance conversation, I'll look at something in the newspaper, and I go, oh my God, I got to run back to the, like, I got it. Like, I just figured out that thing I was killing myself all morning or whatever it is. Now I know how to fix that. That state, like a flow state, I think it's called sometimes, it's impossible to sustain that when you have to be, the kids force you onto the surface of life. You're always on the surface. You're always dealing with stuff that's, you can see, touch, handle. Even if it's their intangible emotions, you're forced to be present for them in a way that, for me, makes it impossible for me to stay in the book.
Right.
Yeah, and that's, like, it's terrifying to me. Like, when I go away and I'm at the McDowell Colony and I realize I solve, like, 15 problems that have been pestering me for 6 months on this book, and I've just been banging my head and writing dozens of pages that turn out to be useless, and like, after 3 days of just being able to do nothing but be with my writing, I've solved all those problems. It can be chilling. It can be a chilling realization. They slow you down. If nothing else, they really slow you down.
Yeah, although there can also be an argument made for proceeding slowly, and that, you know, when you're not, you know, running full speed ahead, there's time for a kind of fermentation.
That's optimistic.
That's like
putting a brave face. No, I mean, I think you're right. And there's definitely, I've gone into those situations and written like 100 pages in a burst of what feels like incredible creative inspiration. And then when I come back, I realize, oh, actually, I can't use any of this. So you're right.
But you don't only do your work at McDowell either. I mean,
no.
You know, my...
I guess, about it, though.
From my perspective, from what I know about your writing patterns in your writing life, you tend to write at night. You
yes.
write from around 10 at night until around 3 or 4 in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
And so not only is the time during which you write so clearly not kid time.
Mm-hmm.
Well, now that you have teenagers and adults, mm-hmm. they're awake during that time, but you're not called upon actively to parent
right.
at that time.
No, I think you're right. It's been a defensive
right.
mechanism in some ways, yeah.
But also, the thing that I've noticed about your particular process is that you're religious about it.
Mm-hmm.
And in a sense, even if you're not working during those daytime hours, even though you're not working during that parenting time, because you've made the promise to yourself to show up at that time
mm-hmm.
and to do your work
mm-hmm.
during those nighttime hours, it strikes me, having seen you around your work, that you're preparing for that work despite the fact that you can't be present in it in the way that you would be if you were at McDowell.
I try, but yes. I mean, I think to some degree, but it's never that, you know, because of course, like, I don't want to be so abstract. Like, I don't want to be abstracted by my work in sort of like seemingly to the other person sort of absent-minded or
yeah,
not really
right.
listening because I'm, you know, that doesn't, you know, I don't want to seem like that to my children. And then I force myself like, okay, no, like focus in
yes.
this very important story about a gerbil that's being told to you, like pay attention.
Well, you talk about that in the essay. You talk about wanting to be present. You talk
mm-hmm.
about knowing what kind of father you wanted to be.
Mm-hmm.
Interestingly, when you talked to Terry Gross a couple days ago, you also said, which I didn't know before, that you always knew that you wanted to have 4 children.
Yeah. I, well, it's like I didn't know that I wanted to, but it seemed like an ideal for me, yeah. That there was this ideal family of four children that I grew up with who were such a unit, and they did all these things together, and there was always this amazing stuff going on, to me, amazing stuff going on at their house. And they had serial manias and obsessions that they shared with, you know, with each other. And like, you know, their mom had gone to an orchard near where we lived and bought this huge bushel of apples. And like they had to eat, everyone, you just had to eat as many apples as you possibly could. And like, everyone was desperately eating apples. And like then there were still too many apples. So they started making things out of apples and trying to carve little apple people. And, you know, like stuff was always happening at that house. And I thought, well, I had two children in my family of birth. And, you know, my brother is much younger than me. There was just never that level of collective enterprise taking place, and I always kind of wish there would be.
Yeah, well, I've heard you talk about your family as if it, and I've experienced this with your family, of sort of seeing the miniature culture that arises within the family, and it strikes me that that was the thing that you wanted to create. You know, you wanted to create a small nation of Shavon Waldmans, as it were.
A fan club.
That's right.
Yeah.
But one of the things that so struck me about this book was that, and that has struck me about your parenting and that I so admire about it, is that you have always allowed your children to be very much who they are, to differentiate within that culture. And I want to talk to you about the essay about Abe, which at least in my mind is sort of the seed for this collection, and about the differentiation you saw taking place within him, and sort of how the idea of that piece unfolded.
Well, I mean, it is... It's not, you know, it's not, there is a sense, I think you have a sense inevitably, you try to get to a place where you're excited to see your children becoming something that you could not have become yourself, that you don't quite understand where it's coming from. You look at yourself, you look at your partner and think like, where did this come from? But it can be hard and it can feel... I mean, so much of the language, so much of the imagery, the cliches that we have around, especially with fathers and sons, but it's true with daughters as well, of like a chip off the old block, and the apple doesn't fall far from the tree, and like father, like son, like there's all these proverbial conventional language that is sort of creating this expectation and this condition in your mind, like what you should take pride in or get nachas from. Are the ways in which your children are like you, right? In the ways that, or like their mother, if it's a virtue of hers, then you see it in your son or your daughter, and you think, yeah, he gets that from you, and that's natural, and it's maybe it's inevitable. I don't know, but it's not necessarily helpful, and it's not necessarily the best thing that you can think or feel at a lot of moments when you see when your children are trying to sort of create their own. Take their own path, and it's very hard sometimes not to have a feeling like, okay, with Abe being interested in fashion, so interested in style, in a way more than fashion. You know, I'm scratching my head, I'm confused by it, but it is. There's something very charming about it. It's very cute. It's you know, like when you see a small human sort of doing something that you tend to associate with much older people, like being a great chess player or whatever it is. Like there's some kind of adorable quality to that. But sometimes there things aren't like that. Sometimes there are things that just seem strange or weird to you, or like, why do you want to do that? Or why are you shoving all those pine cones into your underpants? I don't understand where you get that. Your mother doesn't shove pine cones into her underpants. I don't shove pine cones into my underpants. I'm not really sure I understand why you want to shove pine cones into your underpants. And, you know, at that moment, you have all these overwhelming impulses to say, get those pine cones out of your underpants or whatever. You know, but so from a very early age, your kids, my kids anyway, start to do things that sometimes some of them seem like sort of life determinative, career determinative. They're expressions of talents or preferences, and other things are weird, weird to you, quirks or things that you just don't quite get, and to step back enough to take pleasure in those things, the ones that aren't maybe quite so cute, and see them becoming their, to take pleasure in their differentiation, as you put it, can be challenging.
Yeah, well, I mean, in Abe's case, I remember that even when he was really tiny, you know, like when he was 5 years old and he was getting ready to go to a party, he would, as you write about in the book, he would lay out all of his clothes. Mm-hmm. He would make a little...
Still does it every night. Like every night when I go in to say goodnight to him, the little homunculus is on the floor, spread out on the floor. It's not so little anymore, but like the pants with the socks at the bottoms of the cuff and the sneakers at the bottom of the socks, and then the shirt up here with the hoodie laid on top of it with a sort of, in a kind of a jaunty angle like that. Every single night he's still doing that. Like, I don't think he can actually feel like he's ready for the day to be over until he knows what he's wearing the next day. And then he doesn't, sometimes he revises it.
So how did that move from a private practice for Abe to something that had to do with the commerce of the world? I mean, the indication that we have in the book was that it had something to do with watching Zeke, your older son,
mm-hmm.
and that Zeke's interest in fashion sort of changed something for Abe. But what did you see, and what was the point at which you thought, this is more than just, you know, something that he, some quirk of his, this is something that is going to, in a certain way, define something about his life?
Well, you know, as I describe in the piece, like, he had always had this urge that is very common to all children, small children, to dress up and wear costumes. All kids love that. And when it comes to little boys, very frequently nowadays it takes the form of super wanting to dress up in superhero costumes. And he went through that period, and, like, so did his older brother, so did his older sisters, for that matter. If it was super, sometimes superheroes, sometimes like princess costumes or whatever, they all went through that. Abe always had a hard time understanding why you couldn't wear a costume to school every day, right? And that was like the rule, like, it's only for Halloween or Purim or whatever it is, you can wear a costume, but they don't want the kids wearing costumes. You know, that did never seem right to him. And he very cleverly figured out, pretty early on, he arrived at a way that he could derive whatever pleasure he was getting from putting this costume on, whatever kind of statement he felt like he was making about himself to the world by doing that, in a way that was playing by the rules. And that was, he started to put on his man costume. Like, he would dress like a man. And to him, that meant, I mean, he didn't say that, but that's what was going on, because, like, he would wear like a fedora, suspenders, a bow tie, you know, he would wear like a cardigan with a bow tie,
right,
a little clip-on necktie. You know, he was wearing like man clothes, and the teachers couldn't say anything about that, right? There was no overt violation of the law in his wearing a man costume to school. And so he did that for years. And then finally, I think actually what happened was, if he got teased and taunted about it and like his fedora knocked off and thrown around the playground, and people would play keep away with it. But at a certain point, like, I remember toward the end of second grade, like, I went to school to pick him up one day, and there's like three boys wearing fedoras and like one wearing a bow tie and another one wearing a cardigan, you know. And at that point I was like, oh, well, this is over, right? Like,
right.
Abe's gonna move on from that. And I think
it was
around, you know, just that's around the time that then his older brother starts taking more of an interest in what he's wearing, and Abe latched onto that and began to, you know, to express himself through sort of street fashion and street style. And it was also, he got into hip hop around that time. But I don't think I knew until I took him to Paris. And we're in, like, I knew he was knowledgeable and that he had displayed his knowledge in various ways. But until we were in Paris and we were at these shows and, or we're walking down the street or we're approaching the venue and he's like, you know, Maison Margiela shoes and, you know, that's YSL, that sweater, that's from 2014. And he was in heaven, right? It's like if you're into cars and you go to a car show. Like, for him, he's like seeing in the flesh all of these things that he's only ever seen on the internet before, you know. And that was a moment where I realized, like, wow, I have brought this little, you know, devotee to a holy place for him. Like, he's seeing his gods, you know. He actually got to, you know, see and even shake hands with Rick Owens, you know, who's this legendary figure to him. Like, he, it was, and I didn't really know until that just how deep it went with him.
And he was singled out, really, by Virgil Abloh for this, you know, beautiful ensemble that he had put together. Mm-hmm. The pants from his bar mitzvah suit rolled up to his knees. Mm-hmm.
Kind of like newsboy style, right. Like rolled almost like knicker length.
Right. Yeah. Off-white athletic socks.
Yes.
These silver Adidas.
Yep.
This Maison Margiela shirt.
Mm-hmm. That he had bought with his bar mitzvah money.
Mm-hmm. All of it worn with such an ease of inhabiting those clothes, that sort of eclectic collection of them, that immediately Virgil recognized something about his style, mm-hmm. that sort of seemed to epitomize the thing that he was trying to go for, that in fact exceeded what he was seeing among, you know, the stricter followers of his style.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, can you put a finger on what that was? I mean,
we saw these guys outside when you go to these fashion shows. I mean, Abe was in heaven, I was in hell. Like, I was so bored, and it was so hot in Paris. It was June, it was humid, it was hot. And like they had like, I don't know, they used some special computer algorithm to schedule all of the sequential shows as far as possible from all the preceding ones. So you had to always go all the way across Paris to get to the next one. We were always late. We were always hot. And then you're standing around in line waiting to get in. And then they finally, it's like a ride at Disneyland. Like they finally let you in and it's dark and it's loud. And then it's all like, boom, the lights come on and these like pretend heroin addicts kind of walk past you, and you know, I really, and I'm trying to pretend I'm a journalist, right? I'm like writing about this for GQ, so I'm like taking notes, like orange pants, broken zippers, you know, like all these. I'm trying to inflatable codpiece, you know, like right, like I care, like I would ever want to remember any of this stuff if I didn't have to for this stupid article that for some reason I said I would write. Like, I was really not having a good time. And when we were standing around waiting outside these venues, I was just, you know, just like, this will be over in an hour and a half. Like, and he's looking around and he's seeing these fans, like he's a fan, who are young men, old, much older than he is, but still young men, and they have dressed themselves. And they're not like the young men coming down the runway who are, these are the Rick Owen guys, so they're all wearing all Rick Owen clothes. And here come the, you know, the Yoji Yamamoto guys, and they're all wearing Yoji Yamamoto clothes. And right. The guys you see waiting outside, some of them, they're wearing is stuff they made. They didn't make the clothes themselves. They made the outfit themselves. A piece from here, a piece from there. You know, maybe one expensive piece, and then they, you know, they accessorize it in weird, quirky, individual ways. And he was just so into that, and he hadn't gotten to see that ever before. And that began to immediately, he absorbed it. So that by the time we got to the day with the Virgil Abloh day, the off-white day, you know, he'd had two or three days by then to say like, oh, I get it. Like,
right.
I'm going to start doing what I see these guys doing and create my own look, like truly a look that's mine just for me. So by the time we walked into the off-white thing that we went to, and you know, he was sort of at his peak at that point, and Virgil Abloh, who was so sweet and kind to him, you know, just went far beyond what I ever expected would happen when I thought I was taking Abe, that he got to have this moment with this really clever, creative, inventive designer. You know, Abe was ready. And the proof that Abe was ready was he had worn his off-white socks. Like, he knew he was, Virgil Abloh was going to be seeing him, so he wore the right brand, you know, and that, I think, Virgil Abloh just zeroed in on that right away.
Yeah, he saw this adaptation of what he had created. Mm-hmm. He saw a sort of ideal vision.
We didn't tell him it was the bar mitzvah suit pants rolled up. He didn't have to know that.
What really strikes me, having read this collection as a collection of essays and as a collection of thought about fatherhood in general, was that perhaps part of the reason you were so sensitive to what was going on there for Abe, that part of the reason you saw that despite the fact that the thing that he was so passionate about was different from anything that had excited your passion, mm-hmm. was because mm-hmm. you had had a parallel experience, in a sense, as a kid. Mm-hmm. The last essay in the collection, Pops, is about being with your father on his insurance medical visits. Your father was a physician. He was a pediatrician, mm-hmm. like my mother was. Mm-hmm. And when you are the child of a physician and you go to the hospital or to a visit with your parent, as I often did also with my mom, inevitably the patient or a parent turns to you and says, so, are you going to do this
too? Right, you want to be a doctor too.
And even at that time, you knew that that wasn't your path.
Yes. Well, I mean, it was pretty obvious to me, and my dad also helped me to see that I lacked a lot of the, I had the little plastic doctor bag with the little plastic stethoscope and the Taylor hammer and everything, but that was pretty much the only tools I had to bring to bear on the job.
Can you just talk for a moment about how you came to understand what it was that you were passionate about, what it was that you were drawn to that was so different from your father's particular talents? There's that marvelous scene that you describe in the restaurant.
Yeah, when he's telling me about his childhood. I mean, what I realized was, I mean, I'm not sure it's necessarily, it's a combination of, I realized at a fairly early age that I seem to be noticing more things than people necessarily expected I would be noticing as a kid my age. Like, I seem to be, if I would say, like, oh, did you see the blah, 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 and that was something that had seemed very obvious to me, and then whatever adult I was with would say, like, you saw that, or you noticed that, or how do you know about that, or whatever it was. And I think it was some combination of, that's a skill that a doctor ought to have as well, obviously, but it was some combination of that with a sense of the past, and with the past as my, in particular, as my father, but my mother too, would evoke their pasts and their childhoods. And, you know, I would not only really enjoy hearing those kind of memories, but I really would have this sense of being present, like I had been there. Like, and even though neither of my parents was super skilled storyteller or could really make, it's not like they were giving me richly detailed descriptions. I seemed to be able to sort of supply my own detail, and I didn't know where it was really coming from. So, but I didn't know what that meant or what I would be able to do with it exactly. But I did have this sense of, like, if you tell me something about that happened to you when you were 7 years old, Mom, I'll never forget it, and I will feel as though it happened to me also.
Yeah, I wonder if you could just read that before we take some questions from the audience.
Sure.
This.
What page is it?
Passage on page 120.
In the air conditioned.
Yeah, down to the paragraph.
Okay, right. Yeah, it's remembering how my father, on our way to the do the medical exam, the insurance exam, we went out to dinner at this Mexican restaurant that used to be in Phoenix, Arizona, called Ricardo's. In the air conditioned red darkness of Ricardo's, across from the cigar case, the past and the future became alloyed in my imagination. Magic and science, heroes and villains, brick and steel Brooklyn, and the chromium world of tomorrow. My father, an inveterate list maker, rattled off the names of games, trains, and radio shows, stopping to give little in the way of description. Yet it all came to life for me, as gaudy and vivid and fragrant as those boxes of cigars. Beyond the minimal contours that my father hastily sketched, we had a patient to get to. Some quirk in me, in the wiring of my brain or the capability of my heart, enabled me to ride the bare rails of his memory into the past. In my head, in what I was just coming to understand without even putting a name to it as my imagination, I felt that I was or had been present on Flatbush Avenue at the passing of his vivid, vanished childhood. I did not know how I was managing the trick or what it might be good for. I was not even necessarily aware that I was doing it. But I knew immediately that it was my secret superpower.
That's great. You know, I think that this is one of your very particular superpowers as a writer. It's one of the reasons I so admire your work, the ability to actually take us there and make us present there in the worlds that you describe, whether they're identical to our own or different in some fundamental way. But you've also described, in a sense, the process of empathy, you know, the ability to extend the mind into another's mind.
Mm-hmm.
And you talk a little bit about that in the essay called Against Dickitude,
mm-hmm.
Where you write about how, in order to be the kind of man you want to be, you know, a man who treats women well, a man who's able to do the kinds of things that that make the life of a woman he's involved with actually better. It's necessary to think as a woman, in a sense, to extend the mind into her mind and to imagine, you know, what is it that my partner would want? What would she want me to do? Would she want me to put the wet clothes in the
exactly.
dryer? Yeah, probably mm-hmm. so. Should mm-hmm. I unload the dishwasher? She would want me to do mm-hmm. that. But that's the extension of that essay into the application of empathy to parenthood, I think, is the brilliant stroke there. And I think it's the thing that that I have learned most profoundly from you and Ayala as parents, is that really, in order to be present, what does being present mean? It doesn't just mean being there physically. It doesn't just mean paying attention. It mm-hmm. means actually being able to imagine what it's like to be your kid at that moment.
Mm-hmm.
And I got to thank you for that. I mean, it has really made a difference for me. And it's one of the things that I see. It's one of the threads that I see running through this book.
But if you can't imagine, being present will do.
Yeah,
like being physically present.
That's
like
right.
That's, you know, they'll just, like, there would be moments where I would be playing, you know, playing with one of my kids when they were small. And like by hour two with the Polly Pockets or whatever, like I'm 1,000 miles away, like in my head, whatever I'm doing, I'm just going through the motions and physically, and but I would like feel bad, like, oh, I wonder if she could tell, you know, and I would like look and see, like, is she catching on here that I'm actually don't have the faintest idea what we're talking about or what we're doing or anything, and I would be very certain the answer was no. Like, it was merely
right.
my physical presence, and if I'm simulating effectively, you know, she's calling all the shots. Occasionally, she's like, no, put it over there. Oh, like, yeah, I'll put it over there. Okay.
Well, by that time, you've totally convinced her that
yeah,
you're totally
exactly.
there,
so. So, I mean, it is their appetite for your body, for your physical presence is unslakable. No matter how much you give them, they will take more. They
That's
want
right.
more. Yeah. All right. We have some questions. Thank you. Thank you for indulging me by writing them down. And maybe, oh, here's some more. If you had to co-father a child with a famed writer, who would you choose? That's a weird question. I mean, I like it. I like it as a question. I'm going to seriously consider it. Let me think. If I had to co-father a child, now does that mean there's just two dads? Or is there a mom present too?
That is, it's
still me and another male writer, presumably. Not John Cheever. I don't know. That's hard to imagine. I'm not sure what it's. You're forcing me to actually think about what it would be like to live in a family with two fathers. And I might need time to think about that. What would be important to me? What would be beyond the obvious values of the same kind of co-parenting that goes on with my wife? I don't know. Would I seek to recruit someone who might be able to provide some of the more traditional fatherly things that I myself have proven sort of woefully inadequate in, like teaching a child, say, how to throw a baseball without hitting someone in the face. Like that kind of dude stuff, which I'm not really that good at. Like maybe that would be a good sort of skill to add to the supplement, the package. I'm not really sure. I'll have to think about that. Fishing. I wish I could. I think fishing seems like it might be fun, but I don't know where to start. So I might actually want to go for some super manly, like traditionally masculine kind of dad that then I could just compensate for, you know, like I can teach people how to sew. And I'm pretty good at that, and cook and all those kind of things. I'm not sure. Okay, what is it like for your kids to be such a part of your work and in public? Do you talk about it together? How do you negotiate boundaries between public and private? Carelessly. You know, I mean, the thing is, first of all, there's the fiction and the nonfiction. So in the fiction, things get so mixed up, so qualities from one person get put onto qualities from another person and mingled together, and the result might not even be remotely recognizable to the person that you're borrowing from at all in the end. And so in fiction, it's less of a concern for me. And in fact, I will say that the times when I've drawn on actual behaviors, speech patterns, favorite activities, or whatever it might be of my children, I'm so grateful that I've put those into fiction, because I would have forgotten them otherwise. So like my oldest Sophie, when she was little, she thought that what your heart did was bead. Like she would say, I can feel my heart beating. And I would wonder, like, did she picture like little beads of blood sort of like coming off a necklace in her body somehow? Like that image of beating blood was really striking to me, and I gave it to a little girl in a story that I was writing right at the time that my daughter was saying that. And if I hadn't, I would have totally forgotten that by now, I'm sure of it. Like, so, like, in a way, works of the little pieces, and this has happened not just with my kids, there are like pieces of furniture, you know, a certain chair that is in The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay that if I hadn't put it into that book, I would have forgotten it by now. Then your books become much a kind of like scrapbook in a way. With nonfiction, it's different, because then you're actually sort of clearly identifying the person in question. And if it's one of your children, you do have to be careful. I try to be careful. I try to be mindful. And I check with them. You know, is this okay? I wrote this. Is this all right? Does that bother you? It's hard to predict, though.
Yeah, well, it's interesting to think about the effect of that essay in GQ about Abe and how immediately after that was published and immediately after the photos
right.
of him appeared,
I had no idea.
There was all of this attention paid to what he might be able to do. And you and Ayelet had to make a series of pretty quick decisions about how you wanted to manage that.
Yeah, right? He got all these offers and invitations to become a media superstar, which we ignored. But, you know, even beyond that, just like his, I had no way. So I wrote that piece. I worked very hard to, and it was very difficult to write that piece. It was one of the hardest things I've ever written. And just trying to navigate that line between revealing things about him that he might not want to have revealed and what those things might be, and trying to maintain a certain distance from the piece. I didn't want to just come off like this guy schwitzing about his fashion maven kid. You know, I wanted to have a certain objectivity to it and reach a balance there. It was really hard to do. When I finished it, I gave it to Abe to read, and I said, like, you're in charge. Like, anything you don't like in this, I'm taking it out. You just tell me what it is, no problem. I'll cut anything, I'll change anything. You know, it's up to you. And he read the piece, and he really liked it. But he had a number of very serious, grave objections to incredibly boneheaded factual errors that I had made. So like he gave me this list of like, you got, it's not Margiela, it was YSL, and it wasn't those pants, it was these pants, it was all those shoes are not what I was wearing. And like he had all these factual things, that's totally, and then, you know, the piece was done, I turned it in. I've published things in GQ before, like nothing ever, I never, like somebody would say like, oh, I saw your thing, I was at the beauty parlor, and you know, and that was like 4 months after it came out. It was still lying there, and they saw the article. Like, I never got any feedback from anything I had published in GQ before, and this thing just went, you know, crazy viral, and so there was really no way to have known that was going to happen. I didn't anticipate it. And then we actually did have to face this, even, you know, beyond the things you were talking about, just like Abe, he hated the title of the piece in GQ, which was My Son, the Prince of Fashion,
right.
You know, which I didn't choose that title.
Right.
You never do choose titles in magazines. The editors always choose a title, or there's someone whose job is to pick titles that are guaranteed to offend a 13-year-old boy. And he hated the picture that they chose that was like this big picture. He just really didn't like, he thought his lips looked too big. So like, you know, and then he was getting all this, like kids were saying stuff, and you know, we had to go through a certain amount of there was a certain amount of pain that followed on that, and but you know, we worked through it, and I just kept trying to both validate that he was experiencing that and understand, like, and say, yeah, I get it, that's annoying or whatever, but at the same time also like point out, like, but we did get this incredible trip to Paris, and you got to meet Virgil Abloh, and you know, and he, and that usually, I mean, that is true, and he would be reminded of that and feel somewhat comforted, somewhat consoled. But the thing is, it's also, it's like a mug's game, and you probably know this too. It's like you would go crazy. Yes, I check with my children, but you never know, and they never know. It's like they might say it's fine, and it turns out not to be fine. Or they might say it's, or you might censor yourself in advance and say, well, I better not say that. Okay, I'm going to put it in there. I've wrestled with it. I'm going to go ahead and say it. And then you say it, and the person doesn't notice at all. And then things that you feel are completely innocuous,
yeah,
that would never occur to you, that would offend anyone, offend somebody. And
right.
So you could drive yourself crazy worrying about, you know, that stuff. And so I guess we could have had a rule, I'm never writing anything about my kids, but then what's the point of having them at all? Like you got to get some kind of compensation out of it. Okay, let's see. At what point did people start showing up to your book events? That's a good question. No one's ever asked me that before. When my first book, The Mysteries of Pittsburgh, came out, if I went, I had a few events. That book came out, and I was immediately like placed on in the, there was an article in Newsweek magazine that it was like a roundup of new books, and one was Paul Monette had a new book out, and David Leva had a book out, and somebody else, I'm forgetting now. And then there was my book, and it was like out of the closet and onto the shelves. And I was in this thing of like new, young, gay writers. And so when I went out on my book tour, they booked me into like Lambda Rising Bookstore and Different Drum here. Different Drummer, was that what it was called? Different Drummer. And if I was, when I was in it, and then I was in like a Barnes & Noble and other bookstores, wherever. But if I was in a gay bookstore, I had a nice little turnout, like 12 people. If I went anywhere else, I had like my mom's friend who lives there and her coworker, right? I did an event, I remember, in Sudbury, Massachusetts, outside of Boston. And no one came. And a man got trapped, like I was starting and he was trying to like cross, you know, but we locked eyes and he like sat down. And the woman who was like my escort, my media escort, was driving me around felt so bad for me that she took me to Friendly's next door and bought me like some French fries and an ice cream sundae just to like console me. It took a little while, like even with the second book, it wasn't really until, I mean, I could maybe sometimes have a nice little turnout and then just the next night have almost nobody, but it was when Cavalier and Clay, and it was when, you know, that book came out, and again, I had this sort of, I will say, like, my gay readership has been so loyal and so faithful, and they have never left me, and they carried forward, and then they kind of got added onto my comic book fan readership, and sometimes they overlap, and that, so I started to kind of build, like, constituencies, and then, like, the old Jews came along, and I'm very grateful for their support as well, and, you know, so, like, I built a coalition a little bit at a time of like coteries and sort of interest groups and so on. I think it was one of the readings on the Cavalier and Clay tour, and I had like 100 people there, and I thought like, wow, I didn't think I would ever get to this day. What do you think? What's the timing?
Jessica?
Maybe one or two more questions. Let's see. I'm obsessed with S. Angel, especially the first line, first paragraph. I wish I could recite that by heart, but I can't. Can you talk about how you wrote it? How did you find the voice? Did you start with the punctilio rhyme line? One of my all-time favorites. That story is about a young man who goes to his cousin's wedding in Los Angeles, a Jewish wedding, and he's kind of in love with his cousin, and she's kind of in love with him, but they're cousins, and she's getting married, and he goes to this wedding, and he's seated at a table with this older woman. He's like a man in his early 20s. He's seated at the table with a woman in her mid to late 30s, and he tries to put the moves on her, and it doesn't really work out, and he ends up kissing the new bride, his cousin, at the end of the story, and that seems like a really bad move for both of them, given the fact that she's just gotten married and they're cousins. So, and that story, what does it say? Like he dressed himself. He never went anywhere without expecting that when he got there, he would meet the woman with whom he was destined to fall in love. I wrote that story because my younger brother, who was a student, an undergraduate at UCLA at the time, had a really old, tired, faintly malodorous Japanese hatchback, like a Toyota, I think it was, that he drove everywhere. And one day I was visiting him, and he was going off to a wedding, and I saw him like get into this, by LA standards, you know, very undesirable vehicle, in like dressed up for a wedding, like with a suit. So he was looking all nice, and he got into this car, and there was just something in the contrast of the way he looked and the sort of fresh face and, you know, with a tie and looking, and probably maybe I had a sense of like, when you're young and single and you go off to a wedding, it's always in the back of your mind, you might, you know, meet someone, hook up with someone. And so I saw him having that energy, but also at the same time kind of driving off in this unlucky looking vehicle that seemed to say he wasn't going to meet anybody when he went to this wedding, and in fact he did not. And it was just that conjunction of that somehow stuck with me, and I went home and, you know, started to imagine this story about Ira. All right, the last question, any thoughts to share on Philip Roth? I mean, he was a very, I'll just speak personally because, you know, people can speak much more coherently globally about his importance. But to me personally, I mean, first of all, the summer before I started graduate school at UC Irvine, I was living in my mom's house in Oakland, California, and I was living in their basement, my mom and stepfather's basement. And the shelves down there were all the books that had been my stepfather's when he was like in college. And I knew I was going down to UC Irvine. I knew all the people at UC Irvine were writing novels, and I didn't have a novel, and I felt like I'd better have a novel. So I was going to start a novel right then, but I didn't know what novel or how to write a novel or what did that mean or what was I going to write about. And I just sort of was like standing there fretting and walking back and forth, and I looked, and there was Goodbye Columbus sitting on the shelf, and right next to it, just maybe they were alphabetical, was The Great Gatsby. And people had told me to read The Great Gatsby, and so I had read it, and I hadn't really been, it didn't hit me, but this time I took it and I grabbed it and I read it. I just sat down on the bed there and I read the whole book in 2 hours or whatever, and I was like, ooh, okay. And it really did speak to me, and it really did start to make me think about how a way to write a novel. And then I put it back, and there's Goodbye Columbus right next to it, and I took that down, and that's even shorter than The Great Gatsby, and I read that. And first of all, what I noticed was that clearly Roth had been influenced by Fitzgerald, and like there are very conscious echoes of The Great Gatsby in Goodbye Columbus, and that kind of made me think, oh, well, if Roth could, you know, echo Fitzgerald, then I could echo Roth. And what I noticed about both books immediately was that they were both set in the course of a summer. All the action takes place over one summer, and there seemed to have this inherent sort of three-act structure of June, July, and August. And I thought, okay, that's how you write a novel, obviously. Like, I'm going to write a novel set over a summer, and it's going to have this three-act structure to it. But what really was important to me about reading the Roth right after the Fitzgerald is that I love The Great Gatsby and I love F. Scott Fitzgerald, but that novel is not funny at all. And the parts of it that are supposed to be funny are like the least funny parts of any novel ever. Like the party goer list part in The Great Gatsby that I think every student who's assigned to read that book probably skims really quickly. Whereas Goodbye Columbus is so funny. And I felt so comfortable with the humor in Goodbye Columbus. So that was a valuable clue to me to proceed forward. And so I don't think I could have done The Mysteries of Pittsburgh without having the example of Goodbye Columbus. So, I mean, for that alone, he was an incredibly important writer to me. The other thing I'll just say is The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay was nominated for a Pen Faulkner Award, as was The Human Stain that year. And so I went to Washington, D.C. from California, and Ayelet, my wife, was pregnant with our third kid and was too pregnant to fly. So I took my mom as my date. And my mom was 20 years old when she had me. She's always been she's a very lovely, a very attractive woman. You know, so when the Cavalier and Clay came out in 2000, so I was 37. So my mom was 57. And 2 years older than I am right now. And she was my date. She looked very nice. We saw Philip Roth at this gathering, walked over to him, and I'm like, it's just shaking. And I love his work so much. The Ghost Rider. I want to try to tell him how much the book The Ghost Rider meant to me. I have all these things I want to say to him, and I'm just like stumbling over them. And I always wondered if he liked the humorist S.J. Perlman, this great humorist whose prose is really important to me. I thought I saw echoes of it in his prose, and I like managed to get out this question about S.J. Perlman. He's like, Perlman was just a humorist. Super dismissive, and I'm just like, oh God, I'm dying here. And then like his face brightens, you know, and he's like sort of looking past me, and he's like, who's this? And it was my mom. And my mom loves Philip Roth. She loves his works. You know, he is one of her favorite writers. And so she was only too happy to come over and be introduced to him. And the two of them really hit it off. Well, and like I kind of retreated quietly back to my table and sat down, you know. And so she had a really fun evening. But
I never knew this about your mom.
What's that?
I never knew this about your mom.
Mm-hmm. I mean, she just, you know, I don't know. So I felt like I learned something about Philip Roth that night, but it was not something I didn't necessarily already know. That's what I have to say about Philip Roth. Thank you all very much for coming.
Thank
I really enjoyed
coming.
Talking to you. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to our event featuring Michael Chabon and Julie Oringer. Pops, Fatherhood in Pieces is available at our stores or online at greenlightbookstore.com. If you like this podcast and want to hear more, subscribe on iTunes or look up individual episodes on our website. Also, be sure to rate us on iTunes and find and tag us on social media at GreenlightBKLYN. This podcast is brought to you by the customers of Greenlight Bookstore, who through Shopping Independent make free programming like this available. And if you're not local, be sure to look up your independent bookstore on indiebound.org. We hope you enjoyed this chat and hope to see you again soon. Thanks for dropping by.